CD 3.
Culver City, Tuesday, August 24th, 10:30 a.m. The Venutu litigation team had taken over an old warehouse south of Culver City. It was an industrial area, with potholes in the streets. There was nothing to see from the curb, just a plain brick wall and a door with the street number in battered metal numerals. Evans pushed the buzzer and was admitted to a small walled-off reception area. He could hear the low murmur of voices from the other side of the wall, but he could see nothing at all. Two armed guards stood on either side of the far door leading into the warehouse itself. A receptionist sat at a small desk. She gave him an unfriendly look.
"And you are?"
"Peter Evans, Hassel and Black."
"To see?"
"Mr. Balder."
"You have an appointment?"
"No." The receptionist looked disbelieving.
"I will buzz his assistant."
"Thank you." The receptionist talked on the phone in a low voice. He heard her mention the name of the law firm. Evans looked at the two guards. They were from a private security firm. They stared back at him, their faces blank, unsmiling. The receptionist hung up and said,
"Ms. Haynes will be out in a moment."
She nodded to the guards. One of them came over and said to Evans, "Just a formality, sir. May I see some identification?" Evans gave him his driver's license. "Do you have any cameras or recording equipment on your person?" "No," Evans said. "Any disks, drives, flashcards, or other computer equipment?" "No." "Are you armed, sir?"
"No."
"Would you mind raising your arms for a moment?" When Evans gave him a strange look, the guard said, "Just think of it like airport security." And he patted him down. But he was also clearly feeling for wires. He ran his fingers over the collar of Evans's shirt, felt the stitching in his jacket, ran his finger around his waistband, and then asked him to take off his shoes. Finally, he passed an electronic wand over him.
"You guys are serious," Evans said.
"Yes, we are. Thank you, sir." The guard stepped away, resuming his place at the wall. There was no place to sit, so Evans just stood there and waited. It was probably 2 minutes before the door opened. An attractive but tough-looking woman in her late 20s, with short dark hair and blue eyes, wearing jeans and a white shirt, said,
"Mr. Evans, I'm Jennifer Haynes."
Her handshake was firm. "I work with John Balder. Come this way." They went inside. They were in a narrow corridor with a locked door at the far end. Evans realized it was a security lock. Two doors to get inside.
"What was all that about?" he said, indicating the guards.
"We've had a little trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
"People want to know what's going on here."
"Uh-huh."
"We've learned to be careful."
She held her card against the door, and it buzzed open. They entered an old warehouse, a vast, high-ceiling space, separated into large rooms by glass partitions. Immediately to his left, behind glass, Evans saw a room filled with computer terminals, each manned by a young person with a stack of documents beside their keyboard. In big lettering on the glass, it said "Data, Raw." To his right, there was a matching conference room labeled "Satellites, Radio Sonde." Evans saw four people inside that room, busily discussing huge blow-ups of a graph on the wall, jagged lines on a grid. Farther along, there was another room marked "General Circulation Models, GCMs." Here the walls were plastered with large maps of the world, graphical representations in many colors.
"Wow," Evans said.
"Big operation. Big lawsuit,"
Jennifer Haynes replied.
"These are all our issue teams. They're mostly graduate students in climate science, not attorneys. Each team is researching a different issue for us."
She pointed around the warehouse.
"The first group does raw data, meaning processed data from the Goddard Institute for Space Studies at Columbia University in New York, from the USHCN at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and from Hadley Center in East Anglia, England. Those are the major sources of temperature data from around the world.
I see, Evans said.
Then the group over there works on satellite data. Orbiting satellites have recorded temperatures of the upper atmosphere since 1979, so there is more than a 20-year record. We're trying to figure out what to do about it.
What to do about it?
The satellite data's a problem, she said.
Why?
As though she hadn't heard him, she pointed to the next room. The team there is doing comparative analysis of GCMs, meaning the computer-generated climate models, from the 1970s to the present. As you know, these models are immensely complex, manipulating a million variables or more at once. There are by far the most complex computer models ever created by man. We're dealing with American, British, and German models primarily.
I see. Evans was starting to feel overwhelmed.
And the team down there is doing sea level issues. Around the corner is paleoclimate. Those are proxy studies, of course. And the final team is dealing with solar irradiance and aerosols. Then we have an off-site team at UCLA that is doing atmospheric feedback mechanisms, primarily focusing on cloud cover as it varies with temperature change. And that's about all of it.
She paused, seeing the confusion on Evans's face.
I'm sorry. Since you work with George Morton, I assumed you were familiar with all this stuff.
Who said I work with George Morton?
She smiled. We know our job, Mr. Evans. They passed a final glass-walled room that had no label. It was filled with charts and huge photographs, and three-dimensional models of the Earth set inside plastic cubes.
What's this? He said.
Our AV team. They prepare visuals for the jury. Some of the data is extremely complex, and we're trying to find the simplest and most forceful way to present it.
They walked on. Evans said,
Is it really that complicated?
That's correct, she said. The island nation of Vanuatu is actually four coral atolls in the southern Pacific, which have a maximum elevation of 20 feet above sea level. The 8,000 inhabitants of those islands are at risk of being flooded out by rising sea levels caused by global warming.
Yes, Evans said, I understand that.
But why do you have so many people working on the science?
She looked at him oddly.
Because we're trying to win the case.
Yes.
And it's not an easy case to win.
What do you mean? Evans said. This is global warming. Everybody knows that global warming is...
A voice boomed from the other end of the warehouse. Is what?
A bald, bespectacled man came toward them. He had an ungainly gait and looked like his nickname, the Bald Eagle. As always, John Balder was dressed all in blue, a blue suit, a blue shirt, and a blue tie. His manner was intense. His eyes narrowed as he looked at Evans. In spite of himself, Evans was intimidated to meet the famous litigator. Evans extended his hand. Peter Evans, Hassel and Black.
And you work with George Morton?
Yes, sir, I do.
We are indebted to Mr. Morton's generosity. We strive to be worthy of his support.
I'll tell him that, sir.
I'm sure you will. You were speaking of global warming, Mr. Evans. Is it a subject that interests you?
Yes, sir, it does. And every concerned citizen of the planet.
I certainly agree. But tell me, what is global warming as you understand it?
Evans tried to conceal his surprise. He hadn't expected to be quizzed.
Why do you ask?
We ask everybody who comes here. We're trying to get a feel for the general state of knowledge. What is global warming?
Global warming is the heating up of the Earth from burning fossil fuels.
Actually, that is not correct.
It's not?
Not even close. Perhaps you'd try again.
Evans paused. It was obvious he was being interrogated by a fussy and precise legal mind. He knew the type only too well, from law school. He thought for a moment, choosing his words carefully.
Global warming is, the heating up of the surface of the Earth
from the excess of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that is produced by burning fossil fuels.
Again, not correct.
Why not?
Several reasons. At a minimum, I count four errors in the statement you just made.
I don't understand, Evans said. My statement? That's what global warming is.
In fact, it is not.
Balder's tone was crisp, authoritative.
Global warming is the theory.
Hardly a theory anymore.
No, it is a theory, Balder said. Believe me, I wish it were otherwise. But in fact, global warming is the theory that increased levels of carbon dioxide and certain other gases are causing an increase in the average temperature of the Earth's atmosphere because of the so-called greenhouse effect.
Well, okay, Evans said. That's a more exact definition, but
Mr. Evans, you yourself believe in global warming, I take it.
Of course.
Believe in it strongly.
Sure. Everybody does.
When you have a strongly held belief, don't you think it's important to express your belief accurately?
Evans was starting to sweat. He really felt like he was back in law school. Well, sir, I guess not really in this case. Because when you refer to global warming, everybody knows what you are talking about.
Do they? I suspect that even you don't know what you are talking about.
Evans felt a burst of hot anger. Before he could check himself, he had blurted, "Look, just because I may not be expressing the fine details of the science..."
I'm not concerned about details, Mr. Evans. I'm concerned about the core of your strongly held beliefs. I suspect you have no basis for those beliefs.
With all due respect, that's ridiculous. He caught his breath. Sir.
You mean you do have such a basis?
Of course I do.
Balder looked at him thoughtfully. He seemed pleased with himself.
In that case, you can be a great help to this lawsuit. Would you mind giving us an hour of your time?
I guess so.
Would you mind if we videotaped you?
No, but why?
Balder turned to Jennifer Haynes, who said,
"We're trying to establish a baseline for what a well-informed person such as yourself knows about global warming, to help us refine our jury presentation."
Sort of a mock jury of one?
Exactly. We've interviewed several people already.
Okay, Evans said. I guess I could schedule that at some point.
Now is a good time,
Balder said. He turned to Jennifer.
Get your team together in room 4.
Of course, I'd like to help, Evans said. But I came here to get an over...
Because you've heard there are problems with the lawsuit? There aren't. But there are significant challenges, Balder said.
He glanced at his watch.
I'm about to go into a meeting, he said. You spend some time with Ms. Haynes, and when you're done, we'll talk about the litigation as I see it. Is that all right with you?
There was nothing Evans could do but agree.
Vanuatu team, Tuesday, August 24th, 11 a.m. They put him in a conference room at the end of a long table and aimed the video camera at him from the far end. Just like a deposition, he thought. 5 young people drifted into the room and took seats at the table. All were casually dressed, in jeans and t-shirts. Jennifer Haynes introduced them so quickly that Evans didn't catch their names. She explained that they were all graduate students in different scientific disciplines. While they were setting up, Jennifer slipped into a chair beside his and said,
"I'm sorry John was so rough on you. He's frustrated and under a lot of pressure."
"From the case?"
"Yes."
"What kind of pressure?"
"This session may give you some idea what we're dealing with."
She turned to the others.
"Are we ready?"
Heads nodded. Notebooks flipped open. The camera light came on. Jennifer said,
"Interview with Peter Evans of Hassel & Black on Tuesday, August 24th. Mr. Evans, we'd like to go over your views about the evidence that supports global warming. This isn't a test. We'd just like to clarify how you think about the issue."
"Okay," Evans said.
"Let's begin informally. Tell us what you know about the evidence for global warming."
"Well," Evans said, I know that temperatures around the globe have risen dramatically in the last 20 or 30 years as a result of increases in carbon dioxide that is released by industry when fossil fuels are burned.
Okay.
And by a dramatic rise in temperature, you mean how much?
I think about a degree. Fahrenheit or Celsius?
Fahrenheit.
And this rise has occurred over 20 years.
20 or 30, yes.
And earlier in the 20th century?
Temperatures went up then, but not as fast.
Okay, she said. Now I am going to show you a graph.
She pulled out a graph on foam core backing.
Does this look familiar to you? She asked.
I've seen it before, Evan said.
It's taken from the NASA GATA dataset used by the UN and other organizations. Do you consider the UN a trustworthy source?
Yes.
So we can regard this graph as accurate, unbiased, no monkey business?
Yes.
Good. Do you know what this graph represents?
Evans could read that much. He said, it's the mean global temperature from all the weather stations around the world for the last 100 years or so.
That's right, she said. How do you interpret this graph?
Well, he said, it shows what I was describing. He pointed to the red line. World temperatures have been rising since about 1890, but they start to go up steeply around 1970, when industrialization is most intense, which is the real proof of global warming.
Okay, she said. So the rapid increase in temperature since 1970 was caused by what?
Rising carbon dioxide levels from industrialization.
Good. In other words, as the carbon dioxide goes up, the temperature goes up.
Yes.
All right. Now you mentioned the temperature started to rise from 1890 up to about 1940. And we see here that it did. What caused that rise? Carbon dioxide?
I'm not sure.
Because there was much less industrialization back in 1890. And yet look how temperatures go up. Was carbon dioxide rising in 1890?
I'm not sure.
Actually, it was. Here is a graph showing carbon dioxide levels and temperature.
Okay, Evans said. Just what you would expect. Carbon dioxide goes up and makes temperatures go up.
Good, she said. Now, I want to direct your attention to the period from 1940 to 1970. As you see, during that period, the global temperature actually went down. You see that?
Yes.
Let me show you a close-up of that period.
She took out another chart.
This is a 30-year period, one-third of a century during which temperatures declined. Crops were damaged by frost in summer. Glaciers in Europe advanced. What caused the decline?
I don't know.
Was carbon dioxide rising during that period?
Yes.
So if rising carbon dioxide is the cause of rising temperatures, why didn't it cause temperatures to rise from 1940 to 1970?
I don't know, Evans said. There must have been another factor, or it could be an anomaly. There are anomalies within broad secular trends. Just look at the stock market.
Does the stock market have anomalies that last 30 years?
He shrugged. Or it could have been soot. Or particulate matter in the air. There were a lot of particulates back then, before environmental laws took effect.
Or maybe some other factor. These graphs show that carbon dioxide rose continuously, but temperature did not. It rose and fell, then rose again. Even so, I take it you remain convinced that carbon dioxide has caused the most recent temperature rise.
Yes. Everybody knows that's the cause.
Does this graph trouble you at all?
No, Evans said. I admit it raises some questions, but then not everything is known about the climate. So no, the graph doesn't trouble me.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear it. Let's move on. You said this graph was the average of weather stations around the world. How reliable is that weather data, do you think? I have no idea.
Well, for example, in the late 19th century, the data were generated by people going out to a little box and writing down the temperature twice a day. Maybe they forgot for a few days. Maybe somebody in their family was sick. They had to fill it in later.
That was back then.
Right. But how accurate do you think weather records are from Poland in the 1930s? Or Russian provinces since 1990?
Not very good, I would guess.
And I would agree. So over the last 100 years, a fair number of reporting stations around the world may not have provided high-quality, reliable data.
That could be, Evans said.
Over the years, which country do you imagine has the best-maintained network of weather stations over a large area?
The U.S.?
Right. I think there is no dispute about that. Here is another graph. Does this graph look like the first one we saw of world temperatures?
Not exactly.
What is the change in temperature since 1880?
Looks like a third of a degree.
A third of a degree Celsius in 120 years. Not very dramatic. She pointed to the graph. And what was the warmest year of the last century?
Looks like 1934.
Does this graph indicate to you that global warming is occurring?
Well, the temperature is going up.
For the last 30 years, yes. But it went down for the previous 30 years. And current temperatures in the U.S. are roughly the same as they were in the 1930s. So, does this graph argue for global warming?
Yes, Evans said. It's just not as dramatic in the U.S. as it is in the rest of the world, but it's still happening.
Does it trouble you that the most accurate temperature record shows the least warming?
No, because global warming is a global phenomenon. It's not just the U.S.
If you had to defend these graphs in a court of law, do you think you could persuade a jury of your position?
Or would a jury look at the graph and say, this global warming stuff is nothing serious?
Leading the witness, he said, laughing. In fact, Evans was feeling slightly uneasy, but only slightly. He'd heard such claims before at environmental conferences. Industry hacks could slap together data that they had massaged and twisted and give a convincing, well-prepared speech. And before Evans knew it, he'd start to doubt what he knew. As if she were reading his mind, Jennifer said, "These graphs show solid data, Peter. Temperature records from Goddard Institute for Space Studies at Columbia University. Carbon dioxide levels from Mauna Loa and the Law Dome ice cores in Antarctica. All generated by researchers who believe firmly in global warming."
"Yes," he said. "Because the overwhelming consensus of scientists around the world is that global warming is happening, and it is a major worldwide threat."
"Okay, good," she said smoothly. "I'm glad that none of this changes your views. Let's turn to some other questions of interest. David?" One of the graduate students leaned forward. "Mr. Evans, I'd like to talk to you about land use and the urban heat island effect, and satellite data on the temperature of the troposphere."
Evans thought, oh, Jesus.
But he just nodded. "Okay. One of the issues we're trying to address concerns how surface temperatures change with land use. Are you familiar with that issue?"
"Not really, no."
He looked at his watch. "Frankly, you people are working at a level of detail that is beyond me. I just listen to what the scientists say." "And we're preparing a lawsuit," Jennifer said, "based on what scientists say. This level of detail is where the suit will be fought."
"Fought?" Evans shrugged.
"Who's going to fight it? Nobody with any stature. There isn't a reputable scientist in the world who doesn't believe in global warming."
"On that point, you are wrong," she said.
"The defense will call full professors from MIT, Harvard, Columbia, Duke, Virginia, Colorado, UC Berkeley, and other prestigious schools. They will call the former president of the National Academy of Sciences. They may also call some Nobel Prize winners. They will bring in professors from England, from the Max Planck Institute in Germany, from Stockholm University in Sweden. These professors will argue that global warming is at best unproven and at worst pure fantasy.
Their research paid for industry, no doubt.
A few, not all. Arch-conservatives, neocons. The focus in litigation, she said, will be on the data.
Evans looked at them and saw the concern on their faces, and he thought, they really believe they might lose this thing.
But this is ridiculous, Evans said. All you have to do is read the newspapers or watch television. Newspapers and television are susceptible to carefully orchestrated media campaigns. Lawsuits are not.
Then forget mass media, Evans said, and just read the scientific journal.
We do. They're not necessarily helpful to our side, Mr. Evans. We have a lot to go over. If you'd hold your protestations, we can get on with the issues.
It was at that moment that the phone buzzed, and Balder delivered him from his torment.
Send the guy from Hassel and Black into my office, he said. I have 10 minutes for him.
Vanuatu team, Tuesday, August 24th, 12:04 p.m. Balder was ensconced in a glass-walled office, with his feet up on a glass desk, working his way through a stack of briefs and research papers. He didn't take his feet down as Evans came in.
You find it interesting, he said.
He meant the interrogation.
In a way, Evans said. But if you pardon my saying so, I get the sense they're worried they might lose.
I have no doubt that we will win this case, Balder said. No doubt whatsoever. But I don't want my people thinking that way. I want them worried as hell. I want my team running scared before any trial, and especially this one. We are bringing this suit against the EPA, and in anticipation of that, the agency has retained outside counsel in the person of Barry Beckman.
Whew, Evans said. Big guns.
Barry Beckman was the most famous litigator of his generation. A professor at Stanford Law School at 28, he left the university in his early 30s to go into private practice. He had already represented Microsoft, Toyota, Philips, and a host of other multinationals. Beckman had an incredibly agile mind, a charming manner, a quick sense of humor, and a photographic memory. Everyone knew that when he argued before the Supreme Court, as he had done 3 times already, he cited document page numbers as he answered the justice's questions.
Your Honor, I believe you will find that in footnote 17 on the bottom of page 237, like that.
Barry has his faults, Balder said. He has so much information at his fingertips that he can easily slip into irrelevance. He likes to hear himself talk. His arguments drift. I have beaten him once, and lost him once. But one thing is sure, we can expect an extremely well-prepared opposition.
Isn't it a little unusual to hire an attorney before you've even filed?
It's a tactic, Balder said. The current administration doesn't want to defend this lawsuit. They believe they will win. But they don't want the negative publicity that will accompany their brief against global warming. So they hope to intimidate us into dropping the case. And of course, we never would. Especially now that we are fully funded, thanks to Mr. Morton.
That's good, Evans said.
At the same time, the challenges are significant. Barry will argue that there is insufficient evidence for global warming. He will argue that the supporting science is weak. He will argue that the predictions from 10 and 15 years ago have already been shown to be wrong. And he will argue that even leading proponents of global warming have publicly expressed doubts about whether it can be predicted, whether it is a serious problem, and indeed, whether it's occurring at all.
Leading proponents have said that?
Balder sighed. They have, in journals.
I've never read anything of that sort.
The statements exist. Barry will dig them out.
He shook his head.
Some experts have expressed different views at different times. Some have said rising carbon dioxide isn't a big problem. Now they say it is. So far, we don't have a single expert witness that can't be turned, or made to look very foolish on cross.
Evans nodded sympathetically. He was familiar with this circumstance. One of the first things you learned in law school was that the law was not about truth. It was about dispute resolution. In the course of resolving a dispute, the truth might or might not emerge. Often it did not. Prosecutors might know a criminal was guilty and still be unable to convict him. It happened all the time.
That's why, Balder said, this is going to hinge on the sea level records in the Pacific. We are collecting all available data records now.
Why does the case hinge on that?
Because I believe, Balder said, that this is a case we should bait and switch. The case is about global warming. But that's not where the emotional impact is for a jury. Juries aren't comfortable reading graphs. And all this talk about tenths of a degree Celsius goes right over their heads. It's technical detail. It's the quibbles of experts. And it's incredibly boring for normal people. No, the jury will see this as a case about helpless, victimized, impoverished people being flooded out of their ancestral homelands. A case about the terror of sea levels rising precipitously and inexplicably, with no conceivable cause, unless you accept that something extraordinary and unprecedented has affected the entire world in recent years. Something that is causing the sea levels to rise and to threaten the lives of innocent men, women, and children.
And that something is global warming. Balder nodded.
The jury will have to draw their own conclusions. If we can show them a convincing record of rising sea levels, we will be on very strong ground. When juries see that damage has been done, they are inclined to blame somebody.
Okay. Evans saw where Balder was going. So the sea level data is important.
Yes, but it needs to be solid, irrefutable.
Is that so hard to obtain?
Balder cocked an eyebrow. Mr. Evans, do you know anything about the study of sea levels?
No. I just know that sea levels are rising around the world.
Unfortunately, that claim is in considerable dispute.
You're joking.
It is well known, Balder said, that I have no sense of humor.
But sea level cannot be disputed, Evans said. It's too simple. You put a mark on a dock at high tide, measure it year after year, watch it go up. I mean, how difficult can it be?
Balder sighed. You think sea level is simple. Trust me, it's not. Have you ever heard of the geoid? No. The geoid is the equipotential surface of the Earth's gravitational field that approximates the mean sea surface. That help you?
Evans shook his head.
Well, it is the core concept in the measurement of sea levels.
Balder flipped through the stack of papers in front of him.
How about glacio-hydro-isostatic modeling? Eustatic and tectonic effects on shoreline dynamics. Holocene sedimentary sequences. Intertidal foraminifera distributions. Carbon analysis of coastal paleo environments. Aminostratigraphy. No? Not ringing a bell? Let me assure you, sea level is a fiercely debated specialty.
He tossed the last of the papers aside.
That's what I'm working through now. But the disputes within the field give added importance to finding an unimpeachable set of data.
And you are obtaining this data?
Waiting for them to arrive, yes. The Australians have several sets. The French have at least one in Maria, and perhaps another in Papeete. There is a set that is funded by the V. Allen Willey Foundation. but it may be of too short a duration, and other sets as well. We will have to see.
The intercom buzzed. The assistant said, Mr. Balder, it's Mr. Drake on the line from NERF.
All right.
Balder turned to Evans, extended a hand.
Nice talking with you, Mr. Evans. Again, our thanks to George. Tell him any time he wants to have a look around, he can drop by. We are always hard at work here. Good luck to you. Close the door on your way out.
Balder turned away, picking up the phone.
Evans heard him say, Well, Nick, what the fuck is going on at NERF? Are you going to fix this for me or not?
Evans closed the door. He walked out of Balder's office with a sense of nagging unease. Balder was one of the most persuasive men on the planet. He had known Evans was there on behalf of George Morton. He knew Morton was on the verge of making a huge contribution to the lawsuit. Balder should have been totally upbeat, radiating confidence. And he had indeed begun that way. I have no doubt we will win this lawsuit. But then, Evans had heard, the challenges are significant. I do not have a single expert witness who can't be turned. This is a case we should bait and switch. This case will hinge on C-level records. C-level is a fiercely debated specialty. We will have to see? It certainly wasn't a conversation calculated to raise Evans's level of confidence. Neither, for that matter, was the video session he'd had with Jennifer Haynes discussing the scientific problems the lawsuit would face. But then, as he considered it, he decided that these expressions of doubt were actually a sign of confidence on the part of the legal team. Evans was an attorney himself. He had come to learn the issues surrounding the trial, and they had been forthright with him. It was a case they would win, even though it would not be easy, because of the complexity of the data and the short attention span of the jury. So, would he recommend that Morton continue? Of course he would. Jennifer was waiting for him outside Balder's office. She said,
They're ready for you back in the conference room.
Evans said, I'm really sorry. I can't. My schedule.
I understand, she said. We'll do it another time. I was wondering if your schedule was really tight, or whether there was time for you and me to have lunch.
Oh, Evans said, without missing a beat. My schedule isn't that tight.
Good, she said.
Culver City, Tuesday, August 24th, 12:15 p.m. They had lunch in a Mexican restaurant in Culver City. It was quiet. There were a handful of film editors in the corner from nearby Sony Studios, a couple of high school kids necking, a group of older women in sun hats. They sat in a corner booth and both ordered the special. Evans said, Balder seems to think the C-level data is key.
That's what Balder thinks. Frankly, I'm not so sure.
Why is that?
Nobody's seen all the data. But even if it's high quality, it needs to show a substantial C-level rise to impress a jury. It may not.
How could it not? Evans said. With glaciers melting and breaking off Antarctica.
Even so, it may not, she said.
You know the Maldive Islands in the Indian Ocean? They were concerned about flooding, so a team of Scandinavian researchers came in to study sea levels. The scientists found no rise in several centuries, and a fall in the last 20 years.
A fall? Was that published?
Last year, she said. The food came. Jennifer gave a dismissive wave of her hand. Enough shop talk for now. She ate her burrito with gusto, wiping her chin with the back of her hand. He saw a jagged white scar running from her palm down the underside of her forearm. She said, God, I love this food. You can't get decent Mexican food in D.C.
Is that where you're from?
She nodded.
I came out to help John.
He asked you?
I couldn't turn him down.
She shrugged. So I see my boyfriend on alternate weekends. He comes out here, or I go back there. But if this trial goes forward, it will be a year, maybe 2 years. I don't think our relationship will make it. What does he do, your boyfriend?
Attorney.
Evans smiled. Sometimes I think everyone's an attorney.
Everyone is.
He does securities law. Not my thing.
What's your thing?
Witness prep and jury selection. Psychological analysis of the pool. That's why I'm in charge of the focus groups.
I see.
We know that most people we might put on the jury will have heard of global warming, and most will probably be inclined to think it is real.
Jesus, I'd hope so, Evans said. I mean, it's been an established fact for the last 15 years.
But we need to determine what people will believe in the face of contrary evidence.
Such as
the graphs I showed you today, or the satellite data.
You know about the satellite data?
Evans shook his head.
The theory of global warming predicts that the upper atmosphere will warm from trapped heat, just like a greenhouse. The surface of the Earth warms later. But since 1979, we've had orbiting satellites that can continuously measure the atmosphere 5 miles up. They show that the upper atmosphere is warming much less than the ground is.
Maybe there's a problem with the data.
Trust me. The satellite data have been reanalyzed dozens of times, she said. They're probably the most intensely scrutinized data in the world. But the data from weather balloons agree with the satellites. They show much less warming than expected by the theory.
She shrugged.
Another problem for us.
We're working on it.
How? We think it'll prove too complex for a jury. The details of MSUs, microwave sounding units, cross-track scanners with 4-channel radiance analysis, and the questions about whether Channel 2 has been corrected for diurnal drifts and inter-satellite offsets, time-varying nonlinear instrumental responses. We hope it'll make them throw up their hands. Anyway, enough of all that.
She wiped her face with her napkin, and again he saw the white scar that ran down the underside of her arm.
How did you get that? He said.
She shrugged. In law school.
And I thought my school was tough.
I taught an inner-city karate class, she said. Sometimes it went late. You want any more of these chips?
No, he said.
Shall we get the check?
Tell me, he said.
There's not much to tell. One night I got in my car to drive home, and a kid jumped in the passenger seat and pulled a gun, told me to start driving.
Kid from your class?
No, an older kid, late 20s.
What'd you do?
I told him to get out. He told me to drive. So I started the car, and as I put it in gear, I asked him where he wanted to go. He was stupid enough to point, so I hit him in the windpipe. I didn't hit him hard enough, and he got off around, blew out the windshield. Then I hit him again with my elbow, three times.
What happened to him?
He said. He died.
Jesus, Evans said.
Some people make bad decisions, she said. What are you staring at me like that for? He was 6'2 and 210 and had a record from here to Nebraska. Armed robbery, assault with a deadly weapon, attempted rape, you name it. You think I should feel sorry for him?
No, Evans said quickly.
You do, I can see it in your eyes. A lot of people do. They go, he was just a kid, how could you do that? Let me tell you, people don't know what the hell they're talking about. One of us was going to get killed that night. I'm glad it wasn't me. But of course, it still bothers me.
I'll bet.
Sometimes I wake up in a cold sweat, seeing the gunshot blow the windshield in front of my face, realizing how close I came to dying. I was stupid. I should have killed him the first time.
Evans paused. He didn't know what to say.
You ever had a gun into your head?
She said.
No. Then you have no idea how it feels, do you?
Was there trouble about it? He said.
You bet your ass there was trouble.
For a while I thought I wasn't going to be able to practice law.
They claimed I led him on. Do you believe that shit? I never saw the guy in my life. But then a very good attorney came to my rescue.
Balder?
She nodded. That's why I'm here. And what about your arm? Ah, hell, she said. The car crashed and I cut it on the broken glass. She signaled to the waitress. What do you say we get the check?
I'll do that. Minutes later, they were back outside. Evans blinked in the milky midday light. They walked down the street.
So, Evans said, I guess you're pretty good at karate.
Good enough. They came to the warehouse. He shook her hand. I'd really like to have lunch again sometime, she said. She was so direct about it, he wondered whether it was personal or whether she wanted him to know how the lawsuit was going. Because, like Balder, much of what she had said was not encouraging.
Lunch sounds great, he said.
Not too long.
Deal. Will you call me?
Count on it, he said.
Beverly Hills, Tuesday, August 24th, 5:04 p.m. It was almost dark when he went home to his apartment and parked in the garage facing the alley. He was going up the back stairs when the landlady poked her head out the window.
You just missed them, she said.
Who?
The cable repair people. They just left.
I didn't call any cable repair people, he said. Did you let them in?
Of course not. They said they would wait for you. They just left.
Evans had never heard of cable repair people waiting for anyone.
How long did they wait? Not long. Maybe 10 minutes.
Okay.
He got up to the second floor landing. A tag was hooked on his doorknob. Sorry we missed you. There was a checkbox to call again to reschedule service. Then he saw the problem. The address was listed as 2119 Roxbury. His address was 2129 Roxbury. But the address was on the front door, not the back door. They'd just made a mistake. He lifted his doormat to check on the key he kept there. It was right where he'd left it. It hadn't been moved. There was even a ring of dust around it. He unlocked the door and went inside. He went to the refrigerator and saw the old container of yogurt. He needed to go to the supermarket, but he was too tired. He checked the messages to see if Janice or Carol had called. They hadn't. Now, of course, there was the prospect of Jennifer Haynes. But she had a boyfriend. She lived in D.C., and he knew it would never work. He thought of calling Janice, but decided not to. He took a shower and was considering calling for pizza delivery. He lay down on the bed to relax for a minute before he called, and he fell immediately asleep. Century City, Wednesday, August 25th, 8:59 a.m. The meeting was held in the big conference room on the 14th floor. Morton's four accountants were there, his assistant Sarah Jones, Herb Lowenstein, who did estate planning, a guy named Marty Bren, who did tax work for NERF, and Evans. Morton, who hated all financial meetings, paced restlessly.
Let's get to it, he said. I am supposedly giving $10 million to NERF. And we have signed papers, is that right?
Right, Lowenstein said.
But now they want to attach a rider to the agreement.
Right, Marty Bren said. It's pretty standard boilerplate for them. He shifted through his papers. Any charity wants to have full use of the money they receive, even when it's earmarked for a particular purpose. Maybe that purpose costs more or less than predicted, or it is delayed, or mired in litigation, or set aside for some other reason. In this case, the money has been earmarked for the Vanuatu lawsuit, and the relevant phrase NERF wants to add is said monies to be used to defray the cost of the Vanuatu litigation, including fees, filing, and copying costs, blah, blah.
or for other legal purposes, or for such other purposes as NERV shall see fit in its capacity as an environmental organization.
Morton said, "That's the phrase they want."
"Boilerplate, as I said," Bren said.
"It's been in my previous donation agreements?"
"I don't recall offhand."
"Because," Morton said, "it sounds to me like they want to be able to pull the plug on this lawsuit and spend the money elsewhere."
"Oh, I doubt that," Herb said.
"Why?" Morton said. "Why else would they want this boilerplate? Look, we had a signed deal. Now they want a change. Why?"
"It's not really a change," Bren said.
"It sure as hell is, Marty."
"If you look at the original agreement," Bren said calmly, "it says that any money not spent on the lawsuit goes to NERF for other purposes."
"But that's only if there's money left after the lawsuit ends," Morton said. "They can't spend it on anything else until the suit is decided."
"I think they imagine there may be long delays here."
"Why should there be delays?" Morton turned to Evans. "Peter, what is going on over there in Culver City?"
"It looks like the suit is going forward," Evans said. "They have a large operation. There must be 40 people working on that one case. I don't think they plan to give it up."
"And are there problems with the suit?"
"There are certainly challenges," Evans said. "It's complicated litigation. They face strong opposing counsel. They're working hard."
"Why am I not convinced here?" Morton said. 6 months ago, Nick Drake told me this damn lawsuit was a slam dunk and a great publicity opportunity. Now they want a bailout clause."
"Maybe we should ask Nick."
"I got a better idea. Let's audit NERF."
Murmurs in the room.
"I don't think you have that right, George."
"Make it a part of the agreement."
"I'm not sure you can do that."
"They want a rider? I want a rider. What's the difference?"
"I'm not sure you can audit their entire operation."
"George," Herb Lowenstein said, "you and Nick are friends of long standing. You're their concerned citizen of the year. Auditing them seems a little out of character for your relationship."
"You mean it looks like I don't trust them?"
"Put bluntly, yes."
"I don't."
Morton leaned on the table and looked at everyone sitting there.
"You know what I think? They want to blow off the litigation and spend all the money on this conference on abrupt climate change that Nick is so excited about."
"They don't need $10 million for a conference."
"I don't know what they need. He already misplaced $250,000 of my money. It ended up in fucking Vancouver. I don't know what he is doing anymore."
"Well, then you should withdraw your contribution."
"Uh-uh," Marty Bren said, "not so fast. I think they've already made financial commitments based on the reasonable expectation that the money was coming."
"Then give them some amount and forget the rest."
"No," Morton said. "I'm not going to withdraw the grant. Peter Evans here says the litigation is going forward, and I believe him. Nick says that the $250,000 was a mistake, and I believe him. I want you to ask for an audit, and I want to know what happens. I will be out of town for the next 3 weeks."
"You will? Where?"
"I'm taking a trip."
"But we'll have to be able to reach you, George."
"I may be unreachable. Call Sarah, or have Peter here get in touch with me."
"But George..."
"That's it, guys. Talk to Nick, see what he says. We'll be in contact soon." And he walked out of the room, with Sarah hurrying after him.
Lowenstein turned to the others.
"What the hell was that all about?"
Vancouver, Thursday, August 26th, 12:44 p.m. Thunder rumbled ominously. Looking out the front windows of his office, Nat Damon sighed. He had always known that the submarine lease would mean trouble. After the check bounced, he had canceled the order, hoping that that would be the end of it. But it wasn't. For weeks and weeks he had heard nothing. And then one of the men, the lawyer in the shiny suit, had come back unexpectedly to poke a finger in his face and tell him that he had signed a non-disclosure agreement and could not discuss any aspect of the submarine lease with anybody or risk a lawsuit.
"Maybe we'll win and maybe we'll lose," the lawyer said. "But either way, you're out of business, friend. Your house is mortgaged. You're in debt for the rest of your life. So think it over and keep your mouth shut."
All during this, Damon's heart was pounding. But the fact was, Damon had already been contacted by some sort of revenue service guy, a man named Kenner, who was coming to Damon's office that very afternoon to ask a few questions, he had said. Damon had been afraid that this Kenner would show up while the lawyer was still in his office. But now the lawyer was driving away. His car, a nondescript black sedan with Ontario plates, drove through the boatyard and was gone. Damon started to clean up the office, ready to go home. He was toying with the idea of leaving before Kenner arrived. Kenner was some revenue agent. Damon had done nothing wrong. He didn't have to meet any revenue agent. And if he did, what would he do? Say he couldn't answer questions? The next thing, he'd be subpoenaed or something, dragged into court. Damon decided to leave. There was more thunder, and the crack of distant lightning. A big storm was moving in. As he was closing up, he saw that the lawyer had left his cell phone on the counter. He looked out to see if the lawyer was coming back for it. Not yet. But surely he would realize he had left it and come back. Damon decided to leave before he showed up. Hastily, he slipped the cell phone in his pocket, turned out the lights, and locked the office. The first drops of rain were spattering the pavement as he went to his car, parked right in front. He opened the door and was climbing into the car when the cell phone rang. He hesitated, not sure what to do. The phone rang insistently. A jagged bolt of lightning crashed down, striking the mast of one of the ships in the boatyard. In the next instant, there was a burst of light by the car, a blast of furious heat that knocked him to the ground. Dazed, he tried to get up. He was thinking that his car had exploded, but it hadn't. The car was intact, the door blackened. Then he saw that his trousers were on fire. He stared stupidly at his own legs, not moving. He heard the rumble of thunder and realized that he had been struck by lightning. "My God," he thought, "I was hit by lightning." He sat up and slapped at his trousers, trying to put out the fire. It wasn't working, and his legs were beginning to feel pain. He had a fire extinguisher inside the office. Staggering to his feet, he moved unsteadily to his office. He was unlocking the door, his fingers fumbling, when there was another explosion. He felt a sharp pain in his ears, reached up, touched blood. He looked at his bloody fingertips, fell over, and died.
Century City, Thursday, September 2nd, 12:34 p.m. Under normal circumstances, Peter Evans spoke to George Morton every day, sometimes twice a day. So after a week went by without hearing from him, Evans called his house. He spoke to Sarah.
"I have no idea what is going on," she said. "2 days ago, he was in North Dakota." "North Dakota!" "The day before that, he was in Chicago. I think he might be in Wyoming today. He made noises about going to Boulder, Colorado, but I don't know."
"What's in Boulder?" Evans said.
"I haven't a clue. Too early for snow."
"Has he got a new girlfriend?"
"Sometimes Morton disappeared when he was involved with a new woman."
"Not that I know," Sarah said.
"What's he doing?"
"I have no idea.
It sounds like he has a shopping list."
"A shopping list?"
"Well," she said, "sort of. He wanted me to buy some
kind of special GPS unit? You know, for locating position? He wanted some special video camera using CCD or CCF or something. Had to be rush-ordered from Hong Kong. And yesterday he told me to buy a new Ferrari from a guy in Monterey and have it shipped to San Francisco.
Another Ferrari?
I know. She said, how many Ferraris can one man use? And this one doesn't seem up to his usual standards. From the email pictures, it looks kind of beat up.
Maybe he's going to have it restored.
If he was, he'd sent it to Reno. That's where his car restorer is. He detected a note of concern in her voice. Is everything okay, Sarah? Between you and me, I don't know, she said. The Ferrari he bought is a 1972 365 GTS Daytona Spider.
So?
He already has one, Peter. It's like he doesn't know. And he sounds weird when you talk to him.
Weird in what way?
Just weird. Not his usual self at all. Who's traveling with him? As far as I know, nobody.
Evans frowned. That was very odd. Morton hated being alone. Evans's immediate inclination was to disbelieve it.
What about that guy Kenner and his Nepali friend? Last I heard, they were going to Vancouver and on to Japan, so they're not with him.
Uh-huh.
When I hear from him, I'll let him know you called.
Evans hung up, feeling dissatisfied. On an impulse, he dialed Morton's cell phone, but he got the voicemail. This is George at the beep. And the quick beep.
George, this is Peter Evans. Just checking in to see if there's anything you need. Call me at the office if I can help.
He hung up and stared out the window.
Then he dialed again. Center for Risk Analysis.
Professor Kenner's office, please.
In a moment, he got the secretary. This is Peter Evans. I'm looking for Professor Kenner.
Oh, yes, Mr. Evans. Dr. Kenner said you might call.
He did?
Yes. Are you trying to reach Dr. Kenner?
Yes, I am.
He's in Tokyo at the moment. Would you like his cell phone?
Please. She gave him the number, and he wrote it down on his yellow pad.
He was about to call when his assistant, Heather, came in to say that something at lunch had disagreed with her, and she was going home for the afternoon.
Feel better, he said, sighing.
With her gone, he was obliged to answer his own phone. And the next call was from Margot Lane, George's mistress, asking where the hell George was.
Evans was on the phone with her for the better part of half an hour.
Then Nicholas Drake walked into his office.
I am very concerned, Drake said. He stood at the window, hands clasped behind his back, staring at the office building opposite.
About what?
This Kenner person that George is spending so much time with.
I don't know that they're spending time together.
Of course they are. You don't seriously believe George is alone, do you?
Evans said nothing.
George is never alone. We both know that. Peter, I don't like this situation at all. Not at all. George is a good man. I don't have to tell you that. But he is susceptible to influence, including the wrong influence.
You think a professor at MIT is the wrong influence?
I've looked into Professor Kenner, Drake said, and there are a few mysteries about him.
Oh?
His resume says he spent a number of years in government, Department of the Interior, Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, and so on.
Yes?
The Department of the Interior has no record of his working there.
Evans shrugged. It was more than 10 years ago. Government records being what they are,
possibly, Drake said. But there is more. Professor Kenner comes back to MIT, works there for 8 years very successfully. Consultant to the EPA, consultant to Department of Defense, God knows what else. And then he suddenly goes on extended leave. And no one seems to know what happened to him since. He just fell off the radar.
I don't know, Evans said.
His card says he is director of risk analysis.
But he's on leave. I don't know what the hell he is doing these days. I don't know who supports him. I take it you've met him, briefly. And now he and George are great pals?
I don't know, Nick. I haven't seen or spoken to George in more than a week.
He's off with Kenner.
I don't know that.
But you know that he and Kenner went to Vancouver.
Actually, I didn't know.
Let me lay it out for you plainly, Drake said. I have it on good authority that John Kenner has unsavory connections. The Center for Risk Analysis is wholly funded by industry groups. I needn't say more. In addition, Mr. Kenner spent a number of years advising the Pentagon, and in fact was so involved with them that he even underwent some sort of training for a period of time.
You mean military training?
Yes. Fort Bragg and Harvey Point in North Carolina, Drake said. There is no question the man has military connections, as well as industry connections. And I am told he is hostile toward mainstream environmental organizations. I hate to think of a man like that working on poor George.
I wouldn't worry about George. He can see through propaganda.
I hope so.
But frankly, I do not share your confidence. This military man shows up, and the next thing we know, George is trying to audit us.
I mean, my God, why would he want to do that? Doesn't George realize what a waste of resources that involves? Time, money, everything? It would be a tremendous drag on my time.
I wasn't aware an audit was going forward.
It's being discussed. Of course, we have nothing to hide, and we can be audited at any time. I have always said so. But this is an especially busy time, with the Vanuatu lawsuit starting up and the conference on abrupt climate change to be planned for. All that's in the next few weeks. I wish I could speak to George.
Evan shrugged.
Call his cell. I have. Have you?
Yes.
He call you back?
No, Evan said.
Drake shook his head. That man, he said, is my concerned citizen of the year, and I can't even get him on the phone.
Beverly Hills, Monday, September 13th, 8:07 a.m. Morton sat at a sidewalk table outside a cafe on Beverly Drive at 8 in the morning, waiting for Sarah to show up. His assistant was ordinarily punctual, and her apartment was not far away. Unless she had taken up with that actor again. Young people had so much time to waste on bad relationships. He sipped his coffee, glancing at the Wall Street Journal without much interest. He had even less interest after an unusual couple sat down at the next table. The woman was petite and strikingly beautiful, with dark hair and an exotic look. She might have been Moroccan. It was hard to judge from her accent. Her clothing was chic and out of place in casual Los Angeles. Tight-fitting skirt, spike heels, Chanel jacket. The man who accompanied her could not have been more different. He was a red-faced, beefy American with slightly piggish features, wearing a sweater, baggy khakis, and running shoes. He was as big as a football player. He slumped at the table and said, "I'll have a latte, sweetheart. Non-fat. Grande." She said, "I thought you would get one for me like a gentleman." "I am not a gentleman," he said. "And you're no fucking lady. Not after you didn't come home last night. So we can forget about ladies and gentlemen, okay?"
She pouted. "Cherie, do not make a scene."
"Hey, I asked you to get a fucking latte. Who's making a scene?"
"But Cherie..."
"You gonna get it or not?" He glared at her. "I've really had it with you, Marissa, you know that?"
"You don't own me," she said. "I do as I please."
"You've made that obvious."
During this conversation, Morton's paper had been slowly drifting downward. Now he folded it flat, set it on his knee, and pretended to read. But in fact, he could not take his eyes off this woman. She was extremely beautiful, he decided. although not very young. She was probably 35. Her maturity somehow made her more overtly sexual. He was captivated. She said to the football player, "William, you are tiresome."
"You want me to leave?"
"Perhaps it is best."
"Oh, fuck you," he said, and slapped her. Morton could not restrain himself. "Hey," he said, "take it easy there."
The woman gave him a smile. The beefy man stood up, fists bunched.
"Mind your own fucking business. You don't hit the lady, pal."
"How about just you and me?" he said, shaking his fist. At that moment, a Beverly Hills cruiser drove by. Morton looked at it and waved. The cruiser came over to the curb.
"Everything all right?" one of the cops said. "Just fine, officer," Morton said.
"Fuck this noise," the football player said and turned away. He stalked off up the street. The dark woman smiled at Morton. "Thank you for that."
"No problem.
Did I hear you say you wanted a latte?" She smiled again. She crossed her legs, exposing brown knees. "If you would be so kind." Morton was standing to get it when Sarah called to him. "Hey, George, sorry to be late." She came jogging up in a tracksuit. As always, she looked very beautiful. Anger flashed across the dark woman's features. It was fleeting, but Morton caught it and he thought, something is wrong here. He didn't know this woman. She had no reason to be angry. Probably, he decided, she had wanted to teach the boyfriend a lesson. Even now, the guy was hanging around at the end of the block, pretending to look in a shop window. But at this early hour, all the shops were closed.
"Ready to go?"
Sarah said. Morton made brief apologies to the woman, who made little gestures of indifference. He had the feeling now that she was French.
"Perhaps we will meet again," he said.
"Yes," she said, "but I doubt it. I am sorry, ça va."
"Have a nice day."
As they walked off, Sarah said, "Who was that?"
"I don't know." She sat down at the next table.
"Spicy little number."
He shrugged.
"Did I interrupt something?" "No? That's good." She handed Morton 3 manila folders. "This one's your contributions to NERF to date. This one's the agreement for the last contribution, so you have the language. And this one is the cashier's check you wanted. Be careful with that. It's a big number."
"Okay, it's not a problem. I'm leaving in an hour."
"You want to tell me where?"
Morton shook his head. "It's better you don't know."
End of CD 3.